From June 7th to June 9th, 2002, activists from around the world gathered in Toronto to participate in Biojustice Biodiversity 2002, the sixth international grassroots gathering on genetic engineering. This event was sponsored by the Polaris Institute, the Institute for Social Ecology, Biodevastation Toronto Coalition, and the Council of Canadians. The aim of this event was to challenge the biotech industry's agenda and vision for our future and to broaden the biojustice movement. Conference participants learned, strategized, and networked about genetic engineering in agriculture and medicine, biowarfare, genetic and non-genetic discrimination, international trade, corporate exploitation, science for the public good, intellectual property, and more. The conference was held just before the biotech industry's annual international convention, Bio 2002, which also took place in Toronto. In this report, we'll hear from three of the presenters at Biojustice Biodiversity 2002. We begin with Tina Conlon of Oxfam Canada.
Okay, my name is Tina Conlon. I'm a Canadian Program Officer for Oxfam Canada. My responsibility is in the whole Ontario region and some parts of Quebec. Oxfam Canada is an international development agency that is committed to the equitable distribution of wealth and power.
You talked a lot in your talk here just about feeding the world with biotechnology and what are some of the myths around that. If in your mind, if biotech can't feed the world, what are some of the options?
I think people have been feeding themselves from time immemorial in many different ways, and they have learned different ways of being able to either be a hunter-gatherer or be a cultivator. And I know from time immemorial that there's always been these tensions between a farmer, let's say, and a rancher. That plays itself out. So in some ways, people have been looking at different ways and evolving and developing different ways of feeding themselves from time.
One of the things you talked about is this idea of the first fruit harvest and saving the seeds. Can you explain a little bit more what that is about?
The first fruit harvest is basically a practice done by many farmers around the world, but I first heard of it. It's called Unang Binhi, or the first seeds. It's a way that farmers basically ensure that they can plant again next year. So they will collect from the best seed stocks or the best plants that they have from that year, and set them aside and ensure that for the following year or for the following season, they will have a good set of seeds to plant with. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, when the high-yield variety grain was introduced in the Green Revolution, the ability to collect the first seeds or the first fruits harvest was basically not possible because the high-yield variety hybrids did not lend itself to being able to produce second or third generations. It required a dependence on seed companies to be able to purchase the same seeds. So for the first time, whereas farmers from a time-honored practice were able to set aside their first fruits in order to have grain to ensure planting for the future, are no longer able to do that.
It's from this one commercial that we watched about biotechnology. It seems that the biotech industry is promising everything, to solve everything from poverty to hunger to medical problems throughout the world. What kind of potential do you think that there is?
Well, there's any kind of potential, but right now the potential must be determined by who holds the power or who holds the decision and who controls what happens at this point. Mm-hmm. If the controls remain among those whose mission is to increase the share of its shareholders, then it will be a profit-driven type of a result. It's not something that is equally shared by those who don't have a voice or who are not able to articulate themselves as well, right, or who do not have the power, whether it be money or position, to be able to assert themselves in terms of being able to create some kind of change.
So how do you organize those folks now, and how do you organize farmers to educate each other and to bring more of a balance of power for them?
Oxfam Canada works with people's organizations in the Americas as well as in Africa, works with people's organization that have the ability to actually create changes in their life. As an example, if we're looking at a place in Nicaragua, we're working with a group called Maria Elena Cuadra that actually educates women that they're working with about their rights as workers, their rights to a safe environment, their right not to have to put up with the kinds of things that they put up with. It increases even their ability, because a lot of the times people define their rights according to how somebody defined it for them. And that is how some people are able to keep taking power away from people. And we're not saying that we're there to give power to people that don't, but basically just saying that people have the ability and have the power to and resources to set up their own boundaries, to set up their own controls, and to assert themselves. Unfortunately, sometimes we're operating under systems that don't allow for that kind of ability for people to assert themselves. So the way that we work around that is by having more people. I guess somebody mentioned it earlier. If a lot of the Davids would just unite with each other, right, then you do get a better chance of fighting the Goliaths.
Sure. In Vermont, we've been working locally and in statewide level to get labeling laws passed, especially for the bovine growth hormone, to try to help farmers who are not using genetically engineered foods. Do you work much in policy, and what do you think the potential is for policy initiatives like that?
Just before I joined Oxfam and around the time as well, I was with the Toronto Food Policy Council.
Okay.
And in that council, I think we take some pride in saying that we were able to actually inform people enough and mobilize people enough to bar the entry of BGH into Canada. Mm-hmm. We were also, we have one of our farmers in the Toronto Food Policy Council, Victor Daniels, who was actually able to use the language in NAFTA. Mm-hmm. Deter the introduction of BGH into Canada using that language, basically because BGH alters the ability of the cows to produce milk, and that means it's a genetic interference or change in the genetic nature of that cow, especially when Canada is the leading exporter of bovine sperm. And because of that, the nature of the fact that the BGH would alter this genetic makeup of the cows, this is, in a sense, a contravention of NAFTA rules.
So in your case, the working through policy to not only work on labeling, but also to ban some GMOs from Canada actually worked.
Yes, and actually one of the things that we've also been able to do, one of the things that we were doing at Oxfam, we were doing the World Food Day celebrations for a while. We were able to form coalitions in different areas. In Toronto, as an example, we were able to pull together Food and Hunger Coalition. It's called the Anti-Hunger Coalition or Hunger Watch, which was an excellent way to also spur the municipal government to forming what is called the Food and Hunger Action Committee, which was not only made up of just citizens or ordinary citizens, but it was also composed of, well, there's a buy-in of municipal officers getting into it. So 2 years ago, the City of Toronto was the first city in Canada to have a food charter, which included among itself an equitable, sustainable source for food. Hopefully we would have the mechanisms that would actually enforce that.
Yeah.
But at this point, at least having a food charter is a beginning to do that. The City of Toronto was also able to legislate the purchase of coffee for what they call the Fair Trade Coffee Purchase Policy. And actually it was a legislation that they passed in City Council, which I think is quite significant because the City of Toronto is the fifth largest government in North America, and it's also it's a huge. We've got 45 councillors, I think that's counting the mayor,
right.
Representing a huge area, and so when you're looking at that kind of a purchase policy, you're looking at a purchase policy that represents about $5 million annually. So it's no mean feat, but it's through the power of people getting together and making decisions through policy, through gatherings, and involving government, basically telling government, we elected you into power, we want you to take this into consideration. And so we work with municipality in that way, too.
I think that there is a potential for the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is the extension of NAFTA, which you mentioned earlier, to perhaps supersede some of the local efforts to both label and to stop the importation of GMOs across borders. Like in Europe now, I know that they've been effective at trying to stop some of the genetically modified foods from coming over from North America. What do you think the potential is for us to stop some of the stuff that's going on with the WTO and the Free Trade of the Americas to try to bring some of your efforts into the WTO?
I don't want to paint such a rosy picture about what's happening here because there's a lot of work that is still happening. I want to call your attention to the work that Oxfam is doing right now called Make Trade Fair. We know that on April 11 this year, for instance, Oxfam International launched the Make Trade Fair campaign in 21 countries around the world. And the campaign will focus on politicians, corporations, and the general public as we look to help to transform trade rules. Mm-hmm. Because we feel that trade rules have been not only impartial and unfair, mm-hmm. To make them part of the solution to world poverty instead of being part of the problem as it is now. So, for instance, some of the things that we're calling for is to stop the WTO, IMF, and the World Bank pressing poor countries to opening their markets without regard for the impact on poor people. That's one. We also want to improve employment standards, especially for women. And that's why we've been working on the No Sweat campaign in Toronto. At this point in the City of Toronto, we're trying to get the municipality to ensure that the uniforms it purchases for its employees are not made in sweatshop factories. We also want to remove barriers that stop the 50 poorest countries from selling their goods to rich countries, which is not to say that we are, you know, we're just basically trying to get trade as a big thing, but we're basically saying that trade is unfair. And if we're actually saying that this is the game that we're having people come to join in order to join the world economy, then it's patently unfair. Mm-hmm. So we want to remove those barriers. We want to ban rich countries from subsidizing agricultural exports that undermine the livelihoods of millions of farming families in poor communities. So for instance, we've got many reports of rice dumping, like in Guyana, mm-hmm. where Guyana rice farmers are basically not able to compete against the American imports mm-hmm. that cost much less than what Guyanese farmers cost to produce the product. So how can they compete? Mm-hmm. We also are calling for stabilizing prices for primary commodities such as coffee at higher levels and paying more to small farmers, mm-hmm. And relaxing the last one is relaxing life-threatening patent rules, such as those that restrict the supply of vital medicines to poor countries.
Are those direct policy changes within global governance policy? Within
That's the kind of thing that we're trying to hope to bring to the WTO. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that we're trying to bring to World Fora, because those are the things that were also conveyed to us by our partners, the people that we work with. And these are the kinds of things that we hear them saying that we wanted them to bring in the world discussions. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times in World Fora, decisions are made, contracts are signed sort of like 24 hours before they're brought to the world public. So in some sense, the country itself, let alone the civil society, countries themselves have already signed on to something which they haven't even read, mm-hmm. let alone civil society. So one of the things that Oxfam has been doing is been trying to bring these elements together to bring these voices at the world summits. As an example, Oxfam has worked with the National Farmers Union and in the formation of the Via Campesina, and was very instrumental in some of the great language that was written in World Food Summit in 1996 in Rome.
Wow. One more question. One of the things you mentioned in your talk just now was about the songs of protest that you heard. Can you explain what you meant by that and talk more about that?
I guess as a teenager, when meeting with peasants, I heard about some of the songs that were being sung by some of the peasants, basically asking the question, what happened to the birds? What happened to the butterflies? What happened to the fish that swam in the water? Basically, they were just singing a reality that was happening in their area, and because of the introduction of the Green Revolution, with the introduction of high inputs into the soil, it had created a situation where a lot of these organisms have been killed, and the soil basically has become desertified. Snails, grubs, fish, birds, all of those have basically become not visiting anymore. So I guess I mentioned that particular song because when we talk about when we hear about things like vitamin A rice that's supposed to now solve the problems of the world, mm-hmm. sort of like the Green Revolution Part 2,
right.
And it's meant to supplement the lack of minerals and vitamins in people's diets, not telling you, of course, that you have to eat tons of it before you actually have vitamin A into your system. One of the things that the Green Revolution had done well to destroy are the organisms, the very organisms that were used by peasants normally to supplement their diet. So, for instance, when you go into the rice paddies, and you go into the paddy, you can fish for what they call mudfish, or they use that to supplement their diet. You can go and get the snails and gather them. You can also get around the rice paddies and get those greens that are not cultivated.
Right.
They're non-cultivated food that people basically gather, or what some people call native food, because they don't have a commercial value, simply because they don't keep well. So they're not taken to the market. They're not exported. They're not used for commodities. Basically, but they're very valuable to people that gather them, because they not only provide sustenance, but they also supplement the diet in terms of providing vitamins and minerals and iron and all that kind of thing. So in some ways, the yellow rice can be compared to what I call Wonder Bread. Remember, if you look at Wonder Bread, where you're looking at enriched white bread, where they've taken away all the good things from the grain, they've taken away the bran, they've taken away the germ, and all those wonderful things, and you've come up with basically pure carbo, and they enrich that with additives, and it's supposed to be good for you. So in some ways, this is what I see yellow rice is like. It's like a loaf of enriched white bread.
A Wonder rice patty, maybe.
Something like that. You can call that, yeah.
Okay. Where can folks find out more about Oxfam and your work?
Yes, actually, I'll give you two web pages. The web page for Oxfam is www.oxfam.ca. But I think if all the other Oxfams have also pulled together into because of the Fair Trade campaign, I think it's important that people know about this particular website. It's www.maketradefair.com. Make Trade Fair is one word, and it's a very exciting website because it allows people to participate in making the big noise to actually hopefully be able to create the changes that we want in the world food systems.
Thank you very much.
Next, we will hear from Brian Tokar. Brian is a faculty member and biotechnology project director at the Institute for Social Ecology in Plainfield, Vermont. He is editor of Redesigning Life, the Worldwide Challenge to Genetic Engineering, and is a founding member of the Northeast Resistance Against Genetic Engineering. He has been involved in organizing the biodevastation gatherings since the series began in 1998. The following is an excerpt from his presentation on the biotech industry's connection to chemical warfare.
Back in 1998, as the debates over the genetic engineering of food were first starting to heat up across Europe, the editors of The Economist magazine, probably the leading business magazine in the UK, began their editorial, which was really an impassioned defense of this agenda of genetically engineered food, by saying something quite amazing and quite revealing. Their editorial began, "Agriculture is war by other means." And indeed, the mission of chemical agriculture has been one of warfare. Warfare against our soil, against all the microbes and other living organisms that we depend on for the growing of healthy food. War against the environment, and really ultimately war against ourselves. That is really, in a fundamental way, what this technology is about. And we'll see, as I mentioned, that every one of these companies has played a role in warfare from their origin. The story begins with nitrogen. It's been known since ancient times that nitrogen-based compounds play an important role in soil fertility, and nitrate salts in the form originally of something called saltpeter, which used to be found alongside roadsides and by the foundations of old buildings, were used for many hundreds of years to fertilize soil. The Chinese, of course, in the 12th century discovered that nitrate compounds, when combined with sulfur and a carbon source, are incredibly explosive, and that led to the discovery of and the first development of gunpowder that many centuries ago. During World War I, something very new happened. Two German chemists by the name of Haber and Bosch discovered for the first time an efficient way of chemically synthesizing ammonia, which is a source of nitrate, in the laboratory. And that technology was first commercialized by the BASF company, now the world's fourth largest agrochemical company and increasingly a significant player in crop biotechnology. After World War I, there were huge excesses of nitrate-based compounds in the storehouses of all sides in that war, and that led to the beginning of the mass production of chemical fertilizers. DuPont, which now is the sole owner of Pioneer Hybrid, the world's largest seed company, was the single largest manufacturer of gunpowder in the United States throughout the 19th century. They produced 1.5 billion pounds of high explosives for the Allied forces during World War I. the German dye maker Hoechst, which in the late 1990s and early 2000 merged with the French Rond Poulenc to create the biotech giant Aventis, a name that's familiar, I know, to many of you, began altering its dye formulations for the development of mustard gas and other poison gases, as well as explosives. I should mention that Hoechst and DuPont later shared the role of being two of the world's leading manufacturers of CFCs that have resulted in the destruction of the Earth's protective ozone layer. World War I also brought the rise of Monsanto and made it a major player in the world's chemical industry. Over the course of World War I, Monsanto's profits increased by a factor of 100, from $80,000 a year up to well over $9 million. And their game at the time was being a manufacturer of chemical precursors useful in wartime production, particularly phenol, which is a precursor of TNT and also was used as a major battlefield antiseptic, the nitric acid that's responsible for nitrifying the toluene that's made from phenol to make TNT, a number of precursors for the manufacture of poison gas, additives for rubber for various military uses, and so on. That's when Monsanto became a major player, and from the 1920s on, continued to be in the top 10 of U.S. chemical companies right up until it began divesting its industrial chemical divisions in order to focus on biotechnology in the late 1990s. In addition to manufacturer fertilizers, of course, the other major component of industrial agriculture as we know it is pesticide production. And I'm going to focus in for a little bit on the manufacture and the development of pesticides and the role of these companies in, once again, the parallel development of modern pesticides and modern warfare. In the 19th century and before, pest control was a fairly eclectic enterprise that bore many similarities to the variety of natural pest control methods that we know as organic gardeners and farmers today, using various soaps, herbal preparations, hand removal, and the earliest botanical herbicides, compounds such as pyrethrum and rotenone that began to be known in the 19th century. But the other thing that happened in the middle of the 19th century was the discovery that various byproducts, once again, of the chemical dye industry have important lethal properties. Compounds with names like Paris Green and London Purple were the first mass-produced chemical insecticides. And what these were arsenic compounds. Turns out that during the Victorian era, there were all kinds of arsenic-based compounds in widespread use as dyes for making wallpaper and candles, as cosmetics, as medicinal compounds of various kinds. And it really wasn't until a few decades later that people became aware of how universally toxic arsenic compounds are. The single most widely used pesticide in the early part of the 20th century was, believe it or not, lead arsenate. And it was these same companies that were producing this compound in large quantities. It's also interesting that it was the Europeans that started raising questions about imports of food from the United States that had been treated with lead arsenate herbicide, very much as the Europeans have been in the forefront of resisting genetically engineered foods today. In the 1930s, the technology once again began to shift. It was chemists at the German Bayer Company, which had its origins in dye making, as did all the major chemical companies in Europe at that time. By 1925, Bayer had already been merged into the chemical conglomerate IG Farben, along with all of the other major German chemical companies. And chemists at Bayer discovered that organophosphate compounds are extremely poisonous to to a whole host of living things, humans and mammals and insects alike. And with the integration of all of German industry into the Nazi war machine during the 1930s, we saw the combined development of organophosphate pesticides and organophosphate chemical warfare agents. Bayer, as some of you might be aware, is in the process of acquiring Aventis Crop Science, the purveyor of Starling corn and other scandals over the last several years. During that period, some 2,000 new compounds were discovered, including such notorious chemical warfare agents as tabun, sarin, and soman gases, which are still being manufactured today. After World War II, we saw the development of organophosphate pesticides like Fosmet, which is used to spray livestock and which some researchers have implicated in the development of mad cow disease. Something like 40% of today's insecticide market are still organophosphates, leading to 20,000 cases of acute chemical poisoning every year. These are compounds that send the nervous system into a state of complete havoc. And its mechanism of action against insects is virtually identical to its mode of action in humans and other animals. We're seeing the beginnings of chemical agriculture as we know it taking shape during this period. But the most significant single new development of the World War II period was the development of DDT. Because DDT not only increased the use of chemical agents, toxic chemical agents in agriculture, but qualitatively changed the mindset of commercial agriculture in a way that really made it much more in line with the mentality of warfare. DDT was first synthesized in a laboratory in the 1870s, but it wasn't until the 1930s again that scientists at the J.R. Geigy Company in Switzerland, in their search for chemical compounds that would be useful to prevent moths from feeding on wool, compounds to disinfect seeds, discovered that DDT was useful for both of those purposes. Geigy, of course, merged in the 60s with SIBA to become SIBA Geigy, merged with Sandoz in the late 1990s to form Novartis, and spun off its chemical division just about a year and a half ago to create Syngenta, which today is the world's largest manufacturer of chemical insecticides, only to be overtaken by Bayer if it succeeds in its acquisition of Aventis. Also, the world's largest manufacturer of chemical herbicides. So, Geigy developed the use of DDT for some specific purposes, and it began to be sold around Europe. They tried interesting their U.S. division, but there wasn't a whole lot of interest in DDT here because they were able to do essentially the same things with botanical agents like pyrethrum and rotenone. World War II was really what changed all that. During World War II, the U.S. Army faced two very serious pest control problems. One was the widespread outbreak of typhus spread by lice affecting troops in southern Europe. And the other was the potential for widespread outbreaks of malaria in the South Pacific. They were using pyrethrum-based sprays to disinfect their troops, but pyrethrum was seen as being a little too inconvenient in the military climate of those times. Soldiers had to be extensively sprayed on a weekly basis in a very exacting manner. And the military didn't want to have to keep doing that. Also, Japan had by then become a major exporter of pyrethrum, and of course, that source began to be cut off. So DDT, very early on, became seen came to be seen as the wonder compound that was going to instantly solve all these problems. Inside of just a few months, Geigy and other companies were producing 2 million pounds a month of DDT. And we're starting to do research on other applications of this compound. It demonstrated its ability to kill many agricultural pests quickly and with long duration and potency. Immediately after the war, it began to see widespread use in public health and soon became the single most widely used chemical insecticide in history. Monsanto began manufacturing DDT in 1944, and about a dozen other companies as well. But aside from the sheer quantity of production, I think the most important thing about DDT is it represented a dramatic shift in the mindset of pest control. And this, again, reflects directly this wartime mentality. DDT was the first agent that promised, in their view, the permanent eradication of particular insect pests. And when DDT began to be sold to farmers in large quantities in the late 1940s and early 50s, it was sold as literally the atom bomb of insecticides. Farmers were told that everything they had done in the past to control pests, from botanical controls to habitat control through crop rotation, and again, all of the practices that only began to be revived 10, 15, 20 years later with the beginnings of the organic movement, farmers began to be told that all of these techniques were archaic, were old-fashioned, and should no longer be paid attention to. Research in entomology also underwent a qualitative shift at the time, and Professor John Perkins at Evergreen State College in Washington State has written extensively on this, as well as on the role of DDT in this development, and I suggest people take a look at his work. Research in understanding the ecological relationships among pest species virtually came to a standstill, and academic entomology increasingly became a branch of chemical agribusiness. Over this period, 25 new synthetic pesticides were developed. Insecticide production in the United States alone went from $10 million business in 1940 to a $100 million business in 1950 to well over $1 billion today, greatly contributing to the coffers of those agrochemical companies that we today know as the gene giants. Of course, in the late 50s and early 60s, people came to understand the problems with DDT, that it accumulates in fatty tissues and in milk, that it contributes to liver and kidney degradation. It's a potent central nervous system poison. Then people on college campuses all over the U.S. that were doing research on DDT began to see that every one of them were losing their entire population of songbirds. People saw that DDT was threatening the survival of the bald eagle, and eventually it was discovered that it contributes directly to the thinning of eggshells. In 1992, the use of DDT was banned for domestic agricultural purposes, although, as many of you know, DDT is still manufactured in the United States for export. Bans followed on a whole host of other organochloride insecticides, like aldrin and dieldrin and chlordane and heptachlor. This was the time, in the early 1970s, when the technology of genetic engineering through gene splicing first became available. This is the period of time when companies like Monsanto began shifting their research agendas toward the application of this new technology. In the late 1970s, they were really worried about the chemical industry's ability to continue controlling the way our food is grown. And they saw genetic engineering as the way to maintain that control. And of course, that led to the whole agenda of aggressive promotion of GE crops in the late 1990s. Very quickly, because I'm running out of time, these various companies continue to play a role in closely collaborating with the military throughout the 1950s and the whole second half of the 20th century. Monsanto's research director, along with scientists from DuPont, were involved in supervising the purification of plutonium and polonium for the development of the atomic bomb, and operated the Army's Oak Ridge nuclear weapons lab. In the 1950s, Monsanto discovered dioxin as a byproduct of the manufacture of chlorinated pesticides like 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. And at the very beginnings, there are documents going back to 1952 showing collaboration, conversations between Monsanto and U.S. Army scientists about the potential chemical warfare capabilities inherent in dioxin. That came to fruition during the Vietnam War with the massive defoliation of Vietnam through the use of Agent Orange, which was a mixture of 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. In the 1980s, when a group of Vietnam veterans organizations sued the chemical industry as a result of their own history of horrific side effects from exposure to Agent Orange, of course, the Vietnamese had no such legal recourse in the United States. There was a court settlement in the mid-1980s where the chemical companies, and there were eight companies altogether implicated, had to pay, I think, I don't have the figure right here in front of me, it was something like $180 million settlement. Even though Monsanto, even though Dow Chemical was overwhelmingly the largest producer of Agent Orange, Monsanto had to pay almost 50% of that settlement. Why? Monsanto's Agent Orange had 1,000 times the concentration of dioxin as all of the other formulations. Dow Chemical, of course, was also the manufacturer of the gasoline-based incendiary napalm. And you all know about the history of napalm during the Vietnam War. And Dow became a major gene giant in the late 1990s with its acquisition of the biotech company Mycogen and Cargill's entire North American seed division. Of course, Monsanto's role in herbicide production grew tremendously during the 1980s and 1990s. Roundup went from being, and Roundup family herbicides went from being a sixth of Monsanto's revenue a decade or two ago to being more than two-thirds, the source of more than two-thirds of Monsanto's operating revenue today. And we saw both in Kevin's presentation, Kevin and Juan's, and we also heard from Jan about the role of Roundup-based herbicides in the U.S. drug war in Colombia, where they have formulations of Roundup with 100 times the potency of what's normally used in commercial agriculture. So, as we see, pretty much all of the major players in agricultural biotechnology have their roots in this kind of wartime production and these kinds of very systematic relationships with the world's military forces. It's probably too early to tell which are the companies that will profit most from the kinds of research that we heard about here this evening. To what extent will it be the agrochemical giants? To what extent will it be the pharmaceutical companies with their own insidious history and their own increasing rate of mergers with increasing rate of increasing cost of research as the priorities in medical research shift dramatically toward genetic methods and genetic so-called causes, even in cases like cancer, where we know that the increase in cancer rates over the last couple of generations has absolutely nothing to do with genetics and everything to do with the environmental assaults that we're all exposed to on a daily basis. To what extent will it be some of the smaller new biotech companies that over the last many years have come along to develop new diagnostic methods and some of the new drug development and potentially toxin development methods that Mark outlined, and what kinds of new mergers and acquisitions and arrangements will be made among companies seeking to take advantage of the $3, $4, $5 billion that the U.S. government is currently pledging to spend on so-called biological defense. Once again, our role in this, as people who are aware of this technology and aware of the relationships among these companies, is to expose their role in this process, expose their nefarious histories, and oppose their efforts to both profit from war and be in the forefront of helping to fuel this new arms race. And my approach to this question is really very much along the lines of my approach to the whole range of questions that we face as biotechnology activists, as anti-corporate globalization activists, as advocates for global justice. And it's about reclaiming our rights as citizens, our rights as people living in our communities, to make the fundamental decisions that affect our lives. Whether we're talking about decisions about the nature of our food and the urgency of developing the kinds of locally sustainable food systems that can really sustain us in our communities, whether we're talking about communities gathering to set their own priorities in healthcare within the context, of course, of a comprehensive public healthcare system, and in the U.S. today, we still are the only major industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a real healthcare system. And please don't, in Canada, don't believe the myths that you're told about how wonderful our healthcare in the United States is. We have more people with no health coverage than any other industrialized country in the world. But the decisions about priorities and what our immediate needs are need to be made in our communities within the context of that system. Similarly, decisions about scientific research, about what kinds of questions need to be explored in order to make the world a better place rather than a more dangerous place, I think lie in bodies of ordinary people, meeting with scientists, meeting with physicians, and developing these kinds of strategies. And I think in that kind of setting, we can not only defeat the gene giants and the purveyors of this new climate of permanent war, but really make the world a better place for all of us. Thank you.
This is a song about shutting down the evil institution of your choice. It has a 5-word chorus, and I hope I can get you to join me on it.
We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the shore. They will bring us exploitation. We'll bring them their class war. And we'll lock down to the gates as they're spreading vicious lies. They want to dominate the world. See through their disguise. If they'd have one big multinational with their corporate flags unfurled, searching everywhere for the lowest wages in the world, then we'll have one big union from Melbourne to Prague to Seattle town, wherever they may go. We will shut them down. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down.
The chorus there for anybody that might want to join us, and I encourage you to join us because singing is a good thing, and if you sing together with us, you might feel like you're part of a movement, and if you feel like you're part of a movement, we might just get somewhere.
And CNN will spread the lies. This is just how it's gotta be. They can have their CNN, cause we've got our IMC, and we'll tell the truth quite clearly, though they don't want to hear it, and they'll try to stop our broadcast, cause Because the truth is that they fear it. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. They'd have a world full of strip malls, plants grown by biotech. As long as they get richer, they just don't give a heck. But we don't want their ecocide. We want a world we can live in. That's why we're here to stay, and we're not gonna give in. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. And they will infiltrate us, provocateurs within our ranks. And if they can't divide us, they'll send the planes and tanks. But we will stand together, pacifists and Zapatistas, workers, farmers, the indigenous, tree huggers and baristas. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. And we will build a new world without the corporate elite. And we will see the day of their international defeat. We'll have self-determination and equality for all. For what choice do we really have but to rise up and see them fall? We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down.
Next, we will hear from Dr. David Suzuki, geneticist, author, environmentalist, and TV host of The Nature of Things. The following is an excerpt of his presentation at Sunday's Biodiversity GMO-Free Picnic, a festival of alternatives.
Precisely because of the revolutionary nature of genetics, of biotechnology, that I think we have to consider all the more its potential impact and take it far more seriously than the scientific community is today. With the power to manipulate the very blueprint of all life on Earth, there is a very strong impulse to rush in and exploit this capability for human use, and to forget the fact that while our technological advances has been enormous, our ignorance of how the world really works is still vast. I'd like to give you some history within which to assess genetic engineering. In the 1800s, organic chemists synthesized a molecule, a very complex molecule called DDT. But it wasn't until the 1930s that a chemist named Paul Müller, working for Geigy in Switzerland, discovered that DDT kills insects. Immediately, Geigy saw an opportunity to make money, and they did. And they trumpeted DDT as a symbol of the scientific conquest of pests that had plagued humankind since the beginning of time. Through science, they promised that we would be able to eliminate some of the great scourges of humankind. Now, it was only after billions of pounds of DDT had been made and used, after Geigy had earned millions and millions of dollars in profit, and Paul Müller had won a Nobel Prize in 1948 for his discovery, that people began to notice something funny was happening in birds. And biologists then tracked it down and discovered a phenomenon that had never been known before, called biomagnification. You spray at parts per tens of millions into the surroundings. Microorganisms consume it and absorb it. They are eaten by bigger organisms, and at each trophic level up the food chain, you concentrate the DDT. So when you get to the fatty tissue of the shell glands of birds or the breasts of women, you have concentrated DDT hundreds of thousands of times. We didn't even know about the phenomenon of biomagnification until eagles began to disappear. CFCs. When chemists made CFCs, again, they were hailed as these miraculous compounds, complex molecules that are chemically inert. They don't react chemically with anything else. So they're perfect to put into aerosol spray cans. You put your underarm deodorant or whatever it is you want in the aerosol spray cans, and then you fill it up with CFCs. You top it up. And it was only years later that people realized because they're chemically inert, they don't disappear. They persist in the environment and eventually waft into the upper atmosphere where ultraviolet light from the sun breaks chlorine-free radicals off the CFCs and chlorine-free radicals scavenge ozone. When scientists began to tell us that CFCs cause a thinning of the ozone layer, most of us had never even known there was an ozone layer up there. So over and over again, the history of technology informs us. We are very good, we are very creative at inventing technology. But our knowledge of how the world works is so limited that we are simply unable to anticipate the repercussions of those manipulations. Our technology tells us then to be very, very careful. DDT, CFCs, antibiotics, even radioisotopes eventually decay or break down over time. But genetically engineered organisms are living, reproducing creatures. They mutate, they reproduce, they spread, and once they're released, you can never call them back into the laboratory. That's the context, I believe, within which we should be considering our newfound prowess in biotechnology. Let us consider transgenic organisms or what have become commonly or popularly known as genetically modified organisms in agriculture, GMOs. Throughout evolution, the very definition of a species was a group of organisms that were not able to exchange DNA with others that were closely related to them. That's the very definition of a species. You don't shift DNA between others that are not of the same species. Today, we can take genes from a bacterium, insert them into a plant or animal, from any plant and stick them into an animal, vice versa. This is a simple thing to do. This is revolutionary because in nature, genes aren't transmitted in that fashion. Geneticists study their area. They derive genetic principles by carrying out very simple tests. They take a male and a female of the same species, they cross them, they get their offspring, then they cross the offspring and get their offspring, and so on, all within a single species. This is called vertical inheritance. All of the principles on which genetics is based were derived from vertical inheritance, studying crosses of this type. What transgenic organisms represent is a different kind of inheritance, where you take DNA from one species and transfer it horizontally to an organism of a different species. Vertical inheritance, horizontal inheritance are fundamentally different modes of inheritance. And yet geneticists overwhelmingly make the mistake of assuming that the principles derived from vertical breeding are applicable to horizontal transfer of DNA. To me, it's obvious that is just crummy science. What allows people to make such easy extrapolations? But then I'm told, but Suzuki, you don't understand. You've been out of science so long, it's all DNA. It doesn't matter, it's just pieces of DNA. And DNA in a bird or a bacterium or an animal, they're all the same. All that biotechnologists are doing is just shuffling pieces of DNA around. It's natural. Well, it's not natural for a firefly gene to be inserted into a tobacco plant or a flounder gene to be stuck into a tomato plant, even if it is just DNA that we're manipulating. You see, in nature, evolution doesn't act by selecting on each DNA molecule or each gene by itself. Evolution takes place on, or it selects on, the expression of the total genome of an organism. Genes are inherited after fertilization, and through time, certain suites of genes are turned on or turned off in a very controlled fashion throughout development and differentiation. That's how development proceeds, by the orchestrated activation and inactivation of genes through time. The expression of all of those genes in that orchestration is called an organism's phenotype, the way it appears in the end. Evolution acts on the phenotypic expression of the complete genome, not on each gene by itself. So when you take a gene out of a flounder and stick it into a tomato plant, you have changed the genomic context within which that flounder gene finds itself. It has never found itself in that kind of group of genes. And then what geneticists do is say, well, we're just putting DNA in there and it'll start to function. Something will happen. If you took Bono out of U2 and stuck them into the Toronto Symphony and said, make music, noise would come out of that, but there is no way that you can anticipate the consequences. And yet biotechnologists take a chunk of DNA out of one organism, introduce it into a totally different biological context, and think that they know what they're doing. Their own papers, for God's sake. Just read the papers that come out in biotechnology. Over and over again, what you find is they say, we did this manipulation and we thought we would get this result, and we got something completely unexpected. That's why most of us do science. If you knew what the results were going to be, why the hell would you do the experiment? That's boring. We do science, we do experiments to find things that we didn't know. And most of what biotechnologists are doing is that kind of manipulation. They're surprised, and when they get a surprise, they can then publish it. We don't know the long-term effects of these transgenic manipulations. We don't know what it's going to do to the organisms within which we carry out the manipulations. We certainly don't know what's going to happen when we introduce such organisms into the food stream. And we don't know what's going to happen when we start making drugs which are being used by these manipulations, or we begin to use them for other purposes. It's too early. You know, we've learned through painful experience in the United States and other places that you don't include people in an experiment without getting informed consent. You tell them what the experiment's about, you tell them what you're going to do to them, and then you ask them to say, okay. You know what Europeans, who take food much more seriously than we do in North America, you know what they say about GMOs? If you want to find out whether they're dangerous or not, just watch the Canadians. They're doing the experiment for us. We have been involved in a massive experiment for over 5 years now. GMOs are in the food stream, and we've never given our consent. What these companies and what the governments, which seem to be in cahoots, the governments that we elect and set up institutions to protect our health and our well-being, but who seem to think biotechnology is the greatest thing going and have become cheerleaders for the industry rather than protectors of the public, what they say is that there are enormous, enormous benefits to be gained from genetic engineering, and that we can't afford to lose this wave of technology and stock prices that are passing through our society. I have to tell you that as a geneticist, I can't help but be swept up in the excitement of what's going on. And I certainly understand what the enthusiasm is all about. And it may very well be that in the future, biotechnology may in fact be a very important part of the environmental and the health and the food crises that we are going to encounter in the coming years. But believe me, it's far too soon to have any of this stuff in our food stream, in our medical stream, or out in open fields. It's far too soon. I want to tell you, I graduated I graduated from the University of Chicago with a PhD in 1961. And man, I was as hot as anybody. We knew about DNA and genes and chromosomes. We knew a hell of a lot back then. And we thought we were going to go out and conquer the world. When I tell students in the lab today, in the year 2002, the best, the most advanced models that we had for genetics in 1961, they fall on the floor laughing. Because, of course, in the year 2002, the hot ideas of 1961 seem ludicrous. They are ludicrous. But they don't understand that 20 years from now, when they are hotshot professors, and they tell their students what they believed in 2002, their students are going to fall on the floor laughing at their ideas. Don't we understand the nature of science in any cutting-edge field, in any revolutionary discipline? The nature of science is most of your current ideas are wrong. That's not a denigration of science. It's the very way that science progresses. You make a set of observations. Wow, you've never known that before. Then you try to make sense of those observations by setting up a hypothesis that seems to explain it. Then you do an experiment to test the hypothesis. You get the results. You compare the results with what you predicted. Chances are overwhelming. You say, man, oh man, was I ever wrong? You know, we could better throw that idea out and revise it and make another hypothesis. That's the best. That's the best of science. That's how science progresses. But it means that most of your current ideas are tentative. We propose these ideas with humility, knowing that the chances are overwhelming they're going to be wrong. And it's only when the science has matured to a point where you can actually say, I am going to remove with precision these particular base pairs in a sequence of DNA, and I am going to stitch them into exactly this position on the chromosome of this organism, and I know exactly what the expression of that will be, then you can say, now it's time for us to start going or considering the next level up, which is, how can we apply them? Still with a great deal of care. So what I say is, I'm not saying that we should shut the technology down. I'm just saying that it is an immature science. It's at the beginning of a revolutionary shift in the way that we view everything. And it's far too early to start releasing this out in a way that will affect large numbers of people. I'd also like to tell you that geneticists have... The problem with many geneticists involved in this work today, they've begun to believe what they write up in grant proposals. If you're a scientist, the way you write up a grant proposal is this. You say, you know, whatever your field is, I'm interested in the rectal temperature of penguins or whatever. And you say, now if I go out and measure the rectal temperature of enough penguins, that's going to lead to a new insight into thermal regulation and of Antarctic birds, and that's going to lead to this, and then you end up with a cure for cancer. And that's how we write up our grant proposal. Everybody understands that. You make it seem as if this is what your project is. The reality is, that's not the way science proceeds at all. If that's the way science went, we'd know all the answers to everything. The reality is, science goes zigzagging all over the place, and two people who may be investigating totally unrelated phenomena suddenly come together at a pub and start talking, and they say, Jesus, you know, that's a good idea. Maybe we could, and then you end up leading to a discovery that you can then begin to apply. That's the reality of science. But they really want you to believe that biotechnology is an activity where if we can get the money, we can do this and this and this, and we can save all of the species on the planet, or we can begin to engineer, ramp up the yield of plants in the same amount of ground, and so on. They're not honest with you about the nature of a scientific advance. So I say, if in fact science moves in such an erratic way, if in fact we are at the bare beginning, the infancy of a revolutionary area where we simply don't have the predictive powers of a mature science, if most of our current ideas are wrong, then what the hell is the hurry? What is the rush? And of course, the answer is it's not about saving humanity. It's not about protecting forests and reducing their destruction. It's about money. It's about money that underlies the rush to get products out, that we then rationalize by layering over all of these other excuses for why you want to get this stuff out. So when a Patrick Moore, an apologist for the biotech companies, or when Monsanto begins to tell you about all of the social benefits, my answer is, wait a minute, where do you make your money? Where are you getting paid? And the minute you find the source of the money, then maybe there's a strong reason to suspect the credibility of many of those spokespeople. You are all here. You are all here because you know in your gut, you know in the most deepest visceral part of your body that this is a swizz, that this is something being foisted on us. It doesn't feel right, it doesn't smell right, and you are absolutely right. Thank you for coming out.
This report has been produced by Justin Francese for Free Radio Burlington in Burlington, Vermont. For more information on Free Radio Burlington, email freeradioburl, that's freeradioburl, @yahoo.com. For more information on the BioJustice Biodiversity Conference 2002, log on to www.biodev, that's biodev.org. Theme music for this report was taken from Rob Ikus' new album, What It Is.
This song is called A Brave Heart, and it says exactly what it's for. Talks about that brave heart. And today we want to sing it for all of the people who have a brave heart, who are fighting for the life of our mother, the earth, who are looking for a way in which to help her heal from all of the abuse that she suffered since the coming of those who came on the boat. And so we pray for our Turtle Island, our home, that she's healthy, and that there's an understanding of the importance that she gives to all of us, is that she sustains life. And we're going into the time of her busiest season, which is the summer, and that time of growth, where we all need a brave heart, because to grow, it takes a brave heart, and that's what we want to pray for today, is to open those minds and hearts to that understanding, and to remember all of those who have gone on before us. Miigwech, Home Relations.